About almost exactly 3 years ago on this program, I invited Richard Lathrop and John Magnuson, who are co-chairs of the Wisconsin Institute on Climate Change, to come in and be with us. They were just getting this climate change study underway, and I'm going to have them talk about it. The report now is just out. I had a chance to look at parts of it, and frankly, I was a little depressed in some of the things that I was reading. We can talk with them about that, but maybe also talk about some of the positives that we can take from the study. And certainly we'll take your questions and comments as we move along today. You can join us at 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or email us at talk@wpr.org. And we can talk, you know, maybe what are you concerned about relating to climate change? Worries that you have, looking at where you live, what aspects of your community's life might be affected by climate change. These are some of the things that Richard and John and their group looked at. And again, you can join in. Richard, good to have you back.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
John Magnuson, thank you for coming back, too.
Thanks for having us.
So, 3 years gone by. We're all 3 years older. Are we any wiser? I think we are. You guys are at least a little wiser, perhaps, when it comes to climate change and what's going on in Wisconsin. But I tell you, before we even get into the findings on this, I want to have some background information for listeners so they know kind of who was involved and you know, what effort was involved here. And
yes.
Richard Lathrop, let's go to you for that.
Yeah. Well, as you said, in 2008, in February, we had just launched the Wisconsin Initiative on Climate Change Impacts, or our acronym is WICI. This was a three-year process of doing a science-based assessment of the impacts of climate change, and I want to make it clear that we have not delved into any advocacy for mitigation, meaning greenhouse gas emission reductions. This is all based on will our future be like, and how will we adapt to it, become more resilient as a society and as ecosystems. It's a science-based study. We had the report that was just released, over 30 authors, many editorial people reviewing the report, the content, the Science Council members, 22 members, John and I are co-chairs, reviewed the content of 15 separate working groups that looked at various topic areas, sectors, or geographic regions of the states. And the working groups themselves had 220 scientists, managers, or other experts on them to do their independent assessments.
I like the fact that you really reached out, and you had a broad representation of interests in this among the people involved.
Yes, well, it was not just Madison-centric.
No.
We started with the Wisconsin DNR and the UW-Madison-Nelson Institute for Environmental Studies. This is how it got formed in 2007, but we quickly broadened out to the whole UW system and other agencies, both state and federal, and other partners, including our advisory committee, which has a long list of various groups in the state.
Well, one of the overall findings of is that Wisconsin's climate has been getting warmer, and that it's going to, and getting wetter too, if I'm not mistaken. How did you determine that, and what kind of increases are we talking about?
Well, we have a number of working groups, and one working group we have is populated with climate scientists, and it's a climate working group, and they took on two tasks. One was, how has Wisconsin's climate changed over the last 50, 60 years? And not only how has it changed, but how has it changed here? How has it changed in Superior? How has it changed in Milwaukee? How has it changed at a fine scale across the state? And then they have downscaled these global models to a very fine resolution and have made projections of what our climate may be like by mid-century or the end of the century.
And it's interesting that you not only did it for different parts of Wisconsin, but also looked at changes depending on the season, which I found interesting.
Well, for example, winter projections for winter temperature by mid-century are to be about 8 to 9 degrees warmer, with more warming in the northwestern part of the state as a trend than what we've been seeing. Summer is in the 5 to 6 degrees. These are Fahrenheit temperatures, and spring and fall in between. So some big warming is projected for the state, particularly in the winter and more, even more in the northwest. Precipitation, there's projections that we're going to be somewhat wetter. Winter about maybe 25% wetter. Of course, we don't get a lot of precipitation as actual moisture in the winter, snow, but
right.
But in general, fall, winter, and spring are projected to be wetter. We're going to have a projection of less snow depth and snow cover because of the warming. There'll be more melting. The winter season itself will be shorter, and more rain, an increase in rain events as opposed to snow is projected. Along with these total precipitation changes, we're also projecting more days with intense precipitation, more 2 and 3 inch rainstorm per day rainstorms are projected, particularly in the spring, which is an important finding.
And, you know, Chase in Mineral Point has a comment or question for you. I think it relates in some ways to what you were just talking about, Richard. So let's go there. Chase, hi. Thank you for calling. Are you there, Chase? I think we must have, maybe we lost him. All right. Well, he was, Chase was wondering about the effects of what does climate change have in the way of effects on our groundwater. And I believe there was some report, you had something of that in your report.
Well, one of the changes we expect is, on the positive side, we're expecting more precipitation, more rain. And we would hope that a lot of that new water soaks in and becomes part of the groundwater. And so there is a possibility. And in fact, over the last 30 years or so, except in areas where there's deep water pumping, excessive deep water pumping of groundwater, our groundwater levels have been going up. And I think a lot of people are surprised by that. Now, whether that'll persist, you know, to the end of the century is a more distant question. But recently, groundwater has been going up, and if it's not being removed by deep pumping in urban areas or agricultural areas where there's irrigation, that's good news that our groundwater would be going up.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I'd just like to add to that, though, that in the southern part of the state, we've seen where these groundwater levels have gone up so much there's been some flooding, like in Spring Green. But in the northern part of the state, actually, we've seen a decrease in the amount of precipitation, and has caused water tables to go down, and that has affected some of these northern lakes and wetlands that we consider to be high in the landscape, where they're dependent on direct precipitation and very localized groundwater levels. So some of those ecosystems have actually seen a decline resulting in this less precipitation.
Had a little better summer and fall up there than we did in past years, so hopefully that will do some good.
Yeah, I think what I've heard just recently is that the wet year of 2010 did increase the levels in lakes that are more drainage lakes and lakes that have bigger groundwater flows into them. But again, some of these high in the landscape systems still have not come back. So one of the impacts we can talk about now or later is that in future drought cycles, with increased temperatures, increased evapotranspiration, there could be more stress at the end of these drought cycles because there will be potentially less water getting into them.
Let's turn to Gary, and we'll go back to that, but let's go to Gary in Boscobel. Gary, hi. Thank you for calling.
Thanks, Larry. I wanted to point out that I've been involved with native prairie conservation in the Midwest for about 30 years, and there's changes are subtle, but it seems to be that with the increased rainfall and slightly warmer temperatures, that our problems with prairie conservation are more invasive species working into these areas, and worse problems with brush invasion and tree invasion. And I thought about it, and I'm really concerned, too, because here in the upper Midwest, especially in southern Wisconsin, most of our plant communities here in pre-settlement time were associated with two climatic conditions. One was weather, and the other was fire. And, of course, we've eliminated fire on the landscape for over 100 years. And now with what few species have been able to hang on in the absence of fire, I'm afraid that the increased moisture and increased temperatures are going to really raise havoc with a lot of our bird populations and plant and animal species that are dependent on environments that were evolved under fire.
Yeah. John Magnuson, would you comment?
Well, one of the things you've noticed is that, in fact, the climate zones are moving northward. And Wisconsin had a very famous botanist by the name of Curtis who described a tension zone in the middle of the state. And the projections we have is that that tension zone is going to move northward. North of that tension zone, we had northern species of trees and plants and animals, and south of it, we tended to have southern ones. And that is happening. And that's going to, it also shows up in the projections of what's happening where you can grow various vegetables. Those are moving northward. And pest species for agriculture are moving northward. So one of the side effects of the changing movement, if you like, of these two climate systems, the two biological systems associated with them, is it will mean we will be having more problems with invasive species. We'll also be able to grow certain crops farther north than we ever could before. And one of the things we need to point out is that when we're talking about impacts, this is not a simple story because there are winners and there are losers in almost every area we looked at.
And we're going to get into that in more detail with our two guests today, Richard Lathrop and John Magnuson, co-chairs of the Wisconsin Initiative on Climate Change Impacts. They have the report out now. It's great to have them with us to talk about it. And they'll be with us right up until 12:30 today here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Great to have you along on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here talking about the Wisconsin Initiative on Climate Change Impacts Report. Richard Lathrop and John Magnuson co-chaired the Wisconsin Initiative on Climate Change Impacts. Had them here 3 years ago and when they were getting started, and now with the work of many, many, many researchers and scientists and large numbers of groups, they have their report out. The report talks about where Wisconsin is now, where we may be heading, but it also talks about strategies and adaptations, things that we, and that's an important part of the report, and I want to make sure that we make that plain and that we talk about those adaptations and some of those strategies with our guests as well. And certainly appreciate your calls, your own questions or comments. You can join us at 800-642-1234, or you can email us at talk@wpr.org. We would love to hear from you. And guys, I did want to make the point there that the adaptations and strategies for, you know, dealing with the potential changes we're seeing is an important part of your publication, Dick.
Yes, very much so. That's really what it's all about, is to identify the impacts and vulnerabilities of all these various sectors, topic areas, and some geographic regions of the state, as well as come up with some adaptation strategies. So
I think it's really important that we stress that. We can talk about some of them as we move along here. I know we have callers online to visit with you. We'll take some questions. By the way, before we get to that, though, I want to mention that report itself, which I compliment the preparers of this report, because it's written in a language, it's not written for a scientific audience, it's written for me or for you, sort of an average listener, who may have some knowledge, but certainly not know as much as the people who are putting things together. So I would urge you to take a look at the report And to find it, it's, John, isn't it, go to...
Google WICCI, Wiki, and then on the first page, there's a download button for the full report.
WICCI.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah, and that'll take you to our official website, and there's all kinds of resources on there besides the report, things that people might find interesting, educational materials as well.
Yeah, there's a lot there. Charlie and Monona, we'll turn to you next. Thank you for calling. Hi.
You bet. Good afternoon. There was a report this morning on National Public Radio that Saudi oil supplies are suspected to be much lower than we thought, and that peak oil might be next year. And I guess your point earlier about climate change being a double-edged sword, the bad news is we're going to hit peak oil. The good news is we're going to hit peak oil, which I think would, you know, force us to reduce emissions and help climate change somewhat.
Yeah. All right. John Magnuson?
Well, regardless of what we do in regards to managing our fossil fuels, climate is changing. And under any future climate scenario, we see changes coming in the future that we're going to have to adapt to. And it's these changes in the future and how we would adapt to them that this report deals with. First of all, what is adaptation?
Yeah.
What is it? It's how human systems, from the communities and the small cities to individuals, adjust their natural and human systems in response to not only the actual changes that are occurring, but what they might expect to happen in the next 40, 50 years. And the idea of adaptation, it moderates the harm that might result or to make it a little less,
yeah,
or it exploits the benefits, which would make it a little better. And that's what adaptation is all about.
No, there you go. Thank you very much for calling, Charlie. Appreciate it. Mark in Ashland, let's turn to you. Hi, Mark.
Yeah, boy, this question plays right into the conversation here, but I was very interested to know what your guest would think of the Gaia theory, James Lovelock, the famous climatologist, and where that would, how that would look in northern Wisconsin, say, 7 to 10 years from now.
I've got to tell you what we did. We took the measurements of weather in Wisconsin, of temperature, rainfall, snow, and all of that at a very fine scale, and projected and measured that, analyzed the data over the last 60 years. So we have on our webpage a very clear what's happened. And you will note that northern Wisconsin doesn't respond the way southern Wisconsin has. And the northwest is different than the southeast. So there's a lot of spatial pattern in Wisconsin. In terms of the future, what we've done is our climate group has made a fine scale analysis of the IPCC various scenarios, and we've estimated for the whole state what we might see in 40 to 50 years.
Thank you for calling. I want to go to Dave in West Salem next. Dave, hi to you.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call. See, I'm a vector ecologist, and we're in western Wisconsin. We're doing a lot of work with tick-borne diseases and mosquito-borne diseases that we've had here for quite a long time, but we're seeing such changes. You know, we're seeing Powassan virus to our west in Minnesota. Anaplasmosis is really increasing here in ticks. And, you know, we've seen invasive species like Ocolatratus japonicus in mosquitoes, and I think we're on the brink of stuff like Ocolatratus apopictus. And I wondered if your study looked at some of the potential for human disease from these vectors. And, you know, and the other part of this, too, is it's interesting, too, with earlier springs, we see kind of our common nuisance Aedes vexans coming off a little bit earlier, and what they're doing to nesting birds, cranes, driving them off their nest. So this change, even though they're dependent on sunlight for hatch, these changes are really broad.
Yeah. Richard, go ahead.
Well, yes, we have addressed those issues. This is clearly not the end-all of information, but we have a human health working group, and they looked at increases in the things you've just mentioned, ticks and other vector-borne diseases like mosquitoes, ticks, water-borne diseases, We've discussed the certainly the invasive species is a big problem in a lot of our biodiversity issues in both plants and animals. So our various working groups looked at these issues and identified these problems that you've just mentioned, certainly with warmer climates or warmer temperatures and more moisture in conditions and less cold winters is definitely a recipe for problems in this area. So these have been addressed, but I think we're still more research to be done, more information to analyze and figure out where this is all going.
You might want to take a look at that report, and because there's more detail than we just discussed here, Dave. So I'd highly recommend you go to WICCI, put that in a search engine, and that'll pop up and take a look at it. And we'll probably have it on our Facebook page too. So
yeah, and I'll just follow up. John and I are co-chairs of the Science Council, and there are many people that were involved in the work of these various working groups that are experts in these particular areas that are going to be able to communicate much better on these issues the last listener just raised. And you will find how to make those contacts in the report and the various working groups themselves if you want more information.
Yeah. Good.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks, Dave. Thanks for calling. Eric in Platteville, let's go to you next. Hi, Eric.
Hi. My question is for the gentleman is that I know this is a short snapshot in time for your study, but have you expanded that to look at the patterns of change since European settlers arrived in this area back in the late 1600s? Fur traders, et cetera, when we started looking at what temperatures were and patterns in their writings to get a feel for whether this is a pattern that's changed over time repeatedly in the past or something that is very new to our state.
Mm-hmm.
No, we have not done that. We have focused this report on the last 60 years, and there's a lot of detail on what's happened in Wisconsin over the last 60 years and what we expect may happen in the next 50 years to 100 years. And that's where our focus has been in this particular report. And what you can use this report and what we've been doing as a resource. And it doesn't answer all the issues that people may have on this. But managing and trying to adapt to the changes that are going on right now is really a matter of managing risk management. And it's the framework that we use to discuss how to adapt to climate change. What's the best we can do? Where can we win? Where are we going to lose regardless of what we do? And one way to think about risk is it's the likelihood that something's going to happen, like a really intense snowstorm or a rainstorm, times what's the degree of harm or benefit of that particular event. And it's that risk that we're trying to manage. And we've come up with a whole series of adaptation principles. And perhaps one of the most depressing one is an old strategy that we're all familiar with called triage. And what triage is the systems that we're going to lose or the resources that we're going to lose, and you can't do anything about it. You just let it go. The ones that we don't need to work on are going to make it through this changing climate. You don't need to work on. And where you focus your efforts is in that middle ground where a bit of effort on managing the environment, making changes in how you zone homes and whatnot can make a difference to the damages that you see in the future.
Yeah,
I just want to follow up to the question, too. Our Plants and Natural Habitats Working Group looked at climate analogs that the communities were like using pollen records and things to try to determine what were our ecosystems like back many hundreds of years ago as a way of projecting how in a future climate what some of these communities might be like in different parts of the state. And in fact, we often want to think about where will Wisconsin be using these analogs in the future. I mean, what part of the country might our winters look like where we're familiar with them now. And so there's some of that on our website that can be accessed. And just at yesterday's meeting where we rolled out the report among a bunch of us, over 180 people actually involved with the project, attended this meeting, the climate scientists showed us that they've made progress in this area. And I think much of our winters were going to look more like Toledo. I think that's one of the projections. So,
Ohio. Huh?
Yeah. So these are things that are ongoing, and they're going to refine them. But this is an area where we're trying to do assessments, both retroactive analog analyses as well as projections.
Thanks again, Eric, for calling. Appreciate your call. I want to give Rick and Beaver Dam a chance to join in. Rick, hello to you.
Hi, good morning, and thank you, Larry, for this important program. And
sure.
Mr. Lathrop, Mr. Magnuson, your heroes, thank you so much for your important work. I just wanted to see if I could draw a connection between your last topic, Larry, and this one.
Mm-hmm.
A coalition of hunting and fishing groups recently formed to educate their members and the public about the threats that climate change poses to those activities, hunting and fishing, around the country. And I think it's a really positive development. I think if, conventional environmentalists and hunters and fishermen got together, it could really be a powerful force to enact some wonderful policies that can address some of these threats. I just wondered if your report took a look at some of those impacts on hunting and fishing in Wisconsin, potential impacts and current impacts, because they are substantial.
Yeah. Yes, we've done a lot of that. And it strikes me that the hunting and fishing communities and the persons who are responsible for trying to manage those resources will find a lot of use here. I'm going to pick an example that is especially stressful, and then we'll maybe pick one that's not so bad. But the brook trout. The brook trout streams in Wisconsin, of course, we all know that they require a lot of cold groundwater with a lot of oxygen in it, and they need cool temperatures. The Department of Natural Resource scientists have made estimates of how that might change in the future. And so, for example, a lot of the brook trout streams are fairly far south in Wisconsin. You know, they're out there in the driftless area. And even with a very modest increase in temperature, like 1.4 degrees Fahrenheit in air temperature, which we would expect to be here by certainly by mid-century, there would be a 44% loss in stream miles suitable for brook trout.
No.
If we had a even worse case and it got up to about 4 degrees, we'd have a 94% loss in brook trout streams. Now, that's worst case because there's another phenomena going on. We're getting more rain, and we need to see if there's going to be increases in the groundwater in the southwestern part of the state that will help ameliorate some of that. Not surprisingly, all the stream cold water fishes, both browns and brooks, and even some of the forage fish, are expected to decline in serious ways. But we have a bunch of cool water species like perch and walleye and northern pike, and they're all expected to decline in our streams, not talking lakes right now. And even in the warm water fishes, things like the basses and the bluegills and things like that, four of these are expected to decline in our streams. But the good news is 23 others are expected to increase.
Okay.
And so what would a fisherman to do? One of the things you'd do is you'd put your effort into habitat improvement and increasing the shade over the streams and working with local Trout Unlimited groups and the DNR. You'd certainly try to get the watersheds forested and clean up the watershed management so you get more infiltration of groundwater. And those would delay these kind of events. But your grandchildren may find themselves, even then, fishing for different species than they'd expected and that you were able to.
Very interesting. Thank you, Rick, for calling. Appreciate it. Deborah in Madison has something that may relate to what you were just talking about, John. Deb, hi.
Hi. I may have a couple questions here. If I remember my college biology, trees capture and hold CO2 most effectively. And create oxygen, stabilizing our climate around the globe, enabling us to get from way back distant times to now, when we had a really nice climate going until we started. I hear people talking about diminishing our CO2 emissions with better cars and all that, but I don't hear anyone saying, was there a study perhaps for every square mile covered by city, there should be so many square miles covered by solid trees to hold the effluent.
Mm-hmm.
And also studies of, we now have, I read somewhere that vast, now that we have these vast swaths across the center of the United States, per se, and I think China and Russia are adding to it, too, of like just monoculture, corn, wheat, where it grows, and then it gets slashed away. So for a while, you've got things sucking CO2 out of the air and making plants, but then you cut them all down, and then you burn them. And now we're burning them out our tailpipes and corn. So are we, you know, what about studies that say for every acre of corn, you need an acre or however much or however many board feet or whatever biomass of trees to offset? You know, when they talk about carbon offsets, what about just passive trees?
All right. Well, Richard Lathrop, we'll turn to you first.
That's a really interesting question. Our forestry working group looked at, or at least was aware of, the carbon sequestration issue you brought up about keeping carbon tied up in the biomass of our forests. Our human health group looked at the heat island problems in our cities and the need to be planting more trees just for that. Our wildlife and natural plants and habitats working group have looked at the forests and how we need to maintain contiguous habitats here so that as species would migrate maybe to the north as temperatures warm up, that they have these connections in order to do that. So the issue specifically about how to mitigate greenhouse gases by using it as carbon sequestration is addressed, I think, marginally in our forestry working group, but that wasn't the principal charge. But on the other hand, maintaining good forests for wood products and whatever has to be looking at the use of them for burning too. So these are all complex issues, and the forestry working group has started to address them.
All right. Thank you very much for calling, Deborah. Appreciate your call. And Kurt in Chippewa Falls, it's your turn. Hi, Kurt.
Thank you. Please correct me if I'm wrong, but it appears to me that at least one of the intentions behind this study and in its publication has been to provide a mass of data as objectively as humanly possible, free of any detectable bias or ideological intent and so forth, so that it could be used as a basis of planning across the board in the state for the future. If that's the case, have you succeeded in that, or are you still finding some blowback or pushback from the real estate industry, from developers, from politicians, for that matter?
Yeah.
Well, you're right.
Yeah, go to you, John.
We view the report and also the other documents that we have on the web associated with the report as a resource. And who's that resource for? The resource is for people who are trying to even decide how to deal with their own land. It's for small communities that are trying to figure out how to keep their metropolitan sewage district from flooding over and releasing raw sewage. And the report is full of the information on climate and how climate's going to change, but it is also full of our present status on what we think some of the adaptation strategies that some of these communities might wish to take on and try to implement in their area. Some of the most obvious things, for example, and you've seen that in this last year with the storms we had 2 years ago. We've had groundwater flooding in the Spring Green area. What happened there is that those homes, a number of the people that live there now have been subsidized to move out of that groundwater floodplain.
Yeah.
And the same thing has happened with other towns along the Baraboo. But we need to think ahead more. And what you want to do is make sure that we've got the best definitions of the future climate and where flooding would be expected, and then just don't build there.
Yeah.
And that kind of information would be a resource for communities that are, in fact, trying to minimize these disasters at a later time.
And with that, unfortunately, we have to close. We're out of time. The time flew by. I want to thank Richard and John for being with us today and invite you again to take a look at this report. There's a lot of information in there for a wide variety of groups. You can go to my Facebook page, The Larry Mueller Show. We've got it posted there. Or just go to WICCI, type in that and in your search engine, and you're going to find that report. Thanks again to Richard Lathrop and John Magnuson, and thank you for listening.